Today's Tay Show will be on Case 60 in the Blue Rock Collection. Umon's staff becoming a dragon. Engo's introduction. Buddhas and sentient beings are not by nature different. Mountains, rivers, and your own self are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved, with not a particle of it left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well versed in Zen koans? See the following. Main subject. Umon held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the whole universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" Secho's verse. The staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart. My verse is done. But do you really hear me? Only be carefree. Stand unwavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you another 150. Thank you all very much for coming this morning on this beautiful, beautiful last Saturday of July. Outside the katydid, the cicadas are singing a beautiful, beautiful sound. It's like high summer, hot, you know, hot days, actually a cool morning today. And then as the sun comes up, they start their singing all day, from dawn till dusk. It's really beautiful, beautiful. There's nothing like it in the world. And yet you came here to sit this morning. And I really want to thank you for that. That's just wonderful. Thank you for taking care of my true self so well. The truth is that these Saturday sits are really wonderful training. You know, it's absolutely, if you want to walk the path of Zen, it's absolutely imperative that you practice regularly. When I started out doing Zen, I had read a lot of books on Zen, and my head was full of philosophy. I really had read quite a few books, and I had many ideas about what Zen was. And then I ran into Genki Roshi, my first teacher, and I started sitting with him. And at first I sat once a week. And I would come once a week and sit, and then I would go out with my friend Bill Kugler, and we would have a couple of giant beers. So I'd sit on the cushion. I was reading books on Zen and so on and so on. And I would come once a week to sit, and I would sit, and I would squirm around and barely get through the sits. My legs would hurt, and my mind would be like a beehive. Right? You know, I'd be sitting there thinking, is this what Suzuki means when he says the ontology of emptiness? You know, this is awful. And then after that, I would go and have a big beer, and that would like undo everything. Right? I'd get up the next day and be kind of groggy and go on. And even if I hadn't had a big beer at the end of the night, it wouldn't have been such a good training situation. You know, if you sit once a week, you cannot expect to make much progress in this path, because you're really changing your mental habits. And so reinforcing mental habits requires repetition. And also changing mental habits requires repetition. So once a week and then back to regular lifestyle is not going to produce any change at all. So it's imperative to practice regularly. And when people come here for the first time, I say, could you please try to do this 2 times a week for 15 minutes? And that's a very humble requirement, don't you think? Very modest requirement, rather. 15 minutes, everybody wastes 15 minutes twice a week. So you just say, okay, Tuesdays and Thursdays I'm getting up 20 minutes early, I'll have a sip of coffee and I'll sit on the cushion. And then I'll sit for 15 minutes and then I'll get up and go to my job. See, it's such a modest requirement. So, you know, people usually are willing to do that. And if you do that, and then you come back and sit with us regularly, you'll find that you begin to want to sit more. You'll begin to notice that when you sit on the cushion, your mind gets a little clearer, frustrations leave you a little bit. You get off the cushion anyway feeling better for some mysterious reason. And then after a while you realize some part of yourself really likes the experience. It's like not the conscious part necessarily, but something about yourself likes that experience. And so you want to do more of it. And when that day arrives, lo and behold, there's the Saturday sit. You know? And the Saturday sit is just this wonderful opportunity to come in and practice more intensely. So you can get here at 11 and hear the talk, or you can get here at 9:30 and do 2 periods of sitting, or you can come at 7. Let me just say, a couple of people came last week at 7 for the first time, and I was really impressed. I saw one person after the sit, and this person has just been sitting with the group for a relatively short time. And this person came and sat for the whole Saturday. And I saw this person after the sit, and I said, you did such a wonderful job. And he said, how do you know? And I said, well, you're still here, aren't you? And I think that's a feat, to still be here at the end of 5 hours, right? With, you know, this is quite a bit of sitting. Then, eventually, maybe you want to come to Sesshin, one of our retreats. When you first start sitting, 20 minutes seems so difficult. Seems so difficult. It's like, when is he going to ring that bell? Right? and then, you know, after a while, 20 minutes is nothing. Gary is not here today, but you know, Gary, those of you who come on Thursday night will notice sits next to me, and he often doesn't move for 3 whole sits. So he sits down and he doesn't move for an hour and a half. And he even does that at Sesshin. Now it might be, I don't think he would mind if I told you that when he started sitting, 10 minutes was his limit. Okay, that was many years ago. But little by little, deepened his practice. And it's wonderful to see, you know, wonderful to see somebody sit like that. But really, when he first came here, we had an introductory night. And at that time, our group was much smaller. So on introductory night, there was just Gary, right? And so it was Gary and I, and we would sit for 10 minutes, and then we'd walk around, and then we'd sit for another 10 minutes, and then we'd have tea. And that was really all he could take. But, you know, he made a habit out of getting up every morning during the week, and he would sit at home. And he would tell me, you know, I'm doing half an hour now, I'm doing 40 minutes now, I'm doing an hour now. And that was years ago. I'm confident he still does that. He likes to get up very early and sit. You know, so you start modestly, maybe twice a week on your own, once a week here. Then you come to the Saturday sit, And maybe you do just the talk at first, and then you add an hour, and then one day you do the whole morning. And you know, all this time you're transforming yourself. You may not feel like you're transforming yourself. You know, consciously you might not feel any different, but something's happening. You know, what seemed impossible to accomplish suddenly becomes possible and eventually easy. And we don't exactly know what happens to us when we sit on the cushion. We enter this alternate state, and it's rather difficult to say exactly what's going on. But somehow we're able to stay there in that state more deeply for longer and longer periods of time. You know, and one day you come to the Saturday sit, you do the whole Saturday sit. Maybe the first time you do it, you have to go home and take a nap, right? That's very common. You know, you after the Saturday sit, instead of feeling energized, you're exhausted. You go home and you have lunch, and then you conk out, and then you wake up around 3. Maybe you feel good. Eventually, you won't have to go home and take a nap. You'll go home and you'll be full of energy. This is really going to happen to you. Just keep going. This is really transforming your life. This is the transformation of your life, in my opinion. And now, the interesting thing about all this is, you know, you can start by sitting for 10 minutes. You can move up to half an hour. You can start sitting multiple days of the week. And you can come to the Saturday sit. Then you can come to Sesshin. And then you can do Sesshins many times. So, you know, I've been doing Sesshin for 30 years. And I've usually done between 4 and 7 Sesshin a year, every year for 30 years. And I can't wait for the next one. But there's an interesting fact about practice. Interesting fact that's quite important and that people don't always appreciate. You know, if you're really practicing well, when your teacher gives you a koan, a surprising fact, you're going to notice a surprising fact. When you begin to practice, you imagine the state of awakening in a certain way. So you might imagine that koans are difficult at first, and the more you do, the easier they get. See, this is what we think, because this is how it is with the discriminating mind. So, you know, I have to confess to you that I failed the first quarter of Algebra 1 in high school. I might have told you this story before, but I couldn't understand algebra at all. And I actually would just come in and fail the test. You know, I would actually cry. I would get so frustrated. You know, it was just like another language to me, and I couldn't figure it out. And I had a wonderful teacher who wouldn't, she would give the test, and then we had a makeup during the, in American high schools, there's something called homeroom, or there used to be, where you would go to this place to study, or it was sometimes called study hall also. There was a period during the day when you could go and study. And we couldn't go to study hall. We had to go back to our algebra teacher, and she would work with like the people who were the failures in Algebra 1. So it was so humiliating. You'd be in this room with people, all of whom, there'd be like 3 of us or 4 of us, and we all failed the test again. And it was just humiliating. And I just felt so awful, and I couldn't figure out how to get through Algebra 1. And everybody in there I knew from junior high, and we were all so embarrassed to be there, and we were all clueless, and we couldn't figure out it at all. So my teacher was such a kind person. She actually helped me. And at some point, it was like a light bulb went on in my head, and I figured out how to do these equations. And after that, it got easier and easier. And believe it or not, I actually got A's in Algebra 1 in the second part of the year. So the more algebra I did, the better at it I got. See? And this is true for many things. But actually, it's not true for Zen. I'm not trying to discourage you. In fact, I'm trying to encourage you. Because, you know, if you can do algebra equations, and you can do them faster and faster and easier, at some point, there's really no reason to do algebra equations, right? I mean, it's just it becomes just an empty exercise. There's a moment, you know, when you're struggling with this stuff, where it's really new and exciting, and it's very interesting, and you feel like a door is opening up, because it is. But once it's opened up, there's no sense going back and forth through the door over and over again. It's really a closed book. You can use algebra to do other things, but you know, it's past. It's past. Well, you know, Zen is a very special kind of thing because no matter how experienced you are, no matter how experienced you are, no matter how many sesshin you go to, when your teacher gives you a really good koan, you're going to be right back where you were on day one of Zen practice. That's interesting, isn't it? See, that's very interesting. You know, we imagine that, oh, well, I've done 20 koans. You know, you'll meet people at other Zen centers who say, you know, I've done 20 koans, I've done 50 koans. And it really doesn't mean anything because it doesn't help, or it shouldn't help. If you have a really good teacher and the teacher gives you a really good koan, you know, you're right back to the first day of Zen practice. You're like a raw recruit all over again, just an absolute beginner. And this could seem really depressing, right? And those of you who are working with advanced koans know that this is a little bit disconcerting, you know. You've been practicing for 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. Teacher gives you a koan and you think, this would happen to me. Every time Genki would give me a koan, I would think, this one's going to be easier, you know? I think this, you know, and the koans are so cute sometimes, you know? It's like, what is the sound of one hand clap? You think, oh, that's great, you know, I read about that, that sounds so exciting. You know, 3 years later, you know, you think, whoa, my God, what is this all about? When will it end, you know? And long groping in the dark. But you know, that's really the most wonderful thing in the world. It's really the most wonderful thing in the world because you know you're encountering, I think it means, you know you're encountering something real. You know, if you're just doing textbook problems, you know, in a classical algebra, the teacher comes into the room and says, when the lesson is over, the teacher says, do the even ones tonight and the odd ones for Thursday, right? And it's just, I did the even ones and I did the odd ones, the end, right? Now that's not real. That's a very artificial situation. You know, but when you're working with a koan, these koans are working on a very deep level of a consciousness, and you can't answer the koan without undergoing profound psychological change, more or less profound. So every time you work with a koan, it's new. It's a new koan. And every time you work, in fact, even if you're working with the same koan from one sit to the next, you know, ideally. You're always working with a new koan. So, you know, it's kind of a mistake if you come in to see me in Dokusan and I say, that's a good answer, that's a good beginning answer. You know, it's kind of a mistake to try to build on your answer. That's kind of a mistake. It would be better just to forget everything we just said together and just go back to the koan and start again. In fact, you know, many Zen teachers don't, as I've mentioned before, don't encourage their students. They don't say, you're off to a good start. They just go, fine. You know, that's terrible. You're a million miles away. You call that an answer. You know? And what that does is it plunges you right back into uncertainty again, which is exactly where you want to be. And so there's no advantage to experience. The advantage to experience is that you've been here before, right? I mean, the difference between somebody who's never done a koan and somebody who's worked on five or six or eight koans is that the person who's worked on numerous koans knows how to use this, how to live in this uncertainty, this state of not knowing. See, that's very, not to be troubled by it, but to, you know, it's very energizing not to know. You know, I was reading something the other day by Einstein. And Einstein was, you know, we think Einstein was just a super genius and he always knew what he was doing and he was this wonderful, you know, he wrote E equals MC squared, published the paper, you know. And Einstein was talking about his process of making that discovery, and he talks about being in the dark for years. It was so, and it sounded just like Zen practice. He said, you know, I was in the dark, he said it was like going through a dark hallway for years and then suddenly coming out into the light. You know, and I just like, yes, yes, that's it. You know, that's exactly it. You know, that's how it was for Einstein. You know, that's how it is when we're really, you know, for Einstein that was an intellectually challenging experience, you know, it was an intellectual experience, and the breakthrough was an intellectual experience. But in Zen practice, these breakthroughs are psychological and experiential. They transform and cognitive, right? It's like Zen people are like artists of consciousness or physicists of consciousness. We're transforming consciousness. So consciousness is our medium. Consciousness is our subject. And Einstein's working with the formula, but we're working with consciousness. And we get stuck, and we're trying to overcome certain kinds of obstacles and separations and illusions. And we have to wander blindly through many dark hallways. And then suddenly the door opens and we step into the light. And this is really Zen practice over and over again. And a man of Zen or a woman of Zen is somebody who has lived a long time in that uncertainty and knows that that's the flavor of reality. That's the flavor of life itself. See? That's when you really know you're alive. I think, you know, I think that's really thrilling. But, you know, at first it's a little frightening not to know. And at first it's a little bit depressing because, you know, we put so much importance on sticking up your hand and giving the teacher the right answer. You know, but with real questions, with textbook questions, see, there is a right answer at the back of the book. In fact, I have to confess that I'm not sure I would have gotten through physics. I had to take high school physics, and I had a wonderful old teacher, Mr. Mikovich. And at one point, I was not doing very well in physics, and he said, look, if I give you the answer, maybe you can figure out how to get the answer. So when I would get stuck, he would go up and he would give me the answer, and then I'd sit down patiently, and I would derive, you know, the answer once I knew what it was. And so I got through physics. But that's a phony situation, isn't it? I mean, Einstein didn't know if he really had the answer or not. You know, he didn't know. There wasn't an answer waiting in the book. That's reality. So it was like wandering through dark hallways until the door opens up and you step into the light. And when you step into the light, you're in contact with reality, right? It's like those barriers have fallen and suddenly everything around you is alive with your life and you're alive with the life of the world. This is what Zen is all about. You know, so the first part of this koan has multiple parts, but very interesting question here in Engo's introduction. What does it mean to be well-versed in Zen koans? It means being, D.T. Suzuki, I mentioned him earlier. I used to read D.T. Suzuki's work, and, you know, actually, he's a wonderful writer on Zen. His Dharma name, when he was training as a monk before he had his Daikensho, his Dharma name was in Japanese, the T in his name refers to the Japanese expression for blockhead. Now, you know, D.T. Suzuki might not have been an Einstein, but he was like a super genius, you know. He wrote something like, I don't know, 50 books on Zen. He knew Sanskrit, he knew Chinese. Really, when he brought Zen to the United States, everybody paid attention. Major philosophers. Really, it was astonishing, his influence. Everybody quoted him, and he was just this modest guy, you know. But his teacher called him blockhead. And this is like high compliment, see, to be a blockhead. You know, you sit on the cushion and you're a blockhead today. How are you today? I'm a blockhead. It's like, congratulations. not knowing. You know, the for those of you who are into literature, you know, the great poet Keats had a theory that he called the negative capability. He said that really, the poet that Keats wanted to be anyway, was somebody who could lose himself in the moment. In one of his letters, he talks about watching a billiard ball move across a table. And he said, you know, for a moment, I became the billiard ball. And he said, this is negative capability. See, when you hear the song of the bird and you say, oh, the song of the bird, that's, or you say, I'm enjoying the song of the bird, that's diminished perception. Keats said, you know, when you melt into the song of the bird, that's really hearing the song of the bird. And that's what he called negative capability. Well, Keats was really onto something. See, I think people like Keats or like Einstein, they have a great capacity for negative capability, for not knowing. And they build their life in this place of not knowing. And this is, so what happens if we do that? You see, this is very important. So the first part of the koan is really this question about what does it mean to be experienced Zen practitioner? And I've given you the answer, blockhead. No matter how many koans you do, you're always right back at square one with the next koan. Let's hope. Doors will open. So main subject. Uman held out his staff and he said to the assembled monks, this staff has transformed into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, rivers, and great world? See, now, you know, people don't understand how koans work. This koan is very tricky because he holds up a staff, which is his walking stick, or traditional Zen, traditional insignia of being a teacher at a temple was a walking stick. You were given your teacher's walking stick when you became an abbot. So he's carrying his walking stick and he holds it up to all the monks and nuns in the room. He says, this stick has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. So, you know, what you might think is that somehow you're supposed to concentrate on sticks, or you're supposed to think about the image of the stick becoming a dragon. You know, it has something to do with sticks and dragons or something like that. You know, and actually this is a misunderstanding of how koans work. You know, koans don't really work metaphorically. They don't really work as a philosophical statement either. Koans have to be internalized and processed on a deep, unconscious level. See, most of our mental life is really unconscious. You know, we Western people and we modern people don't like to admit this, but it's so true. See, the non-conscious part of the mind processes much more information than the conscious part of the mind. And so in Zen practice, we're learning how to use our big mind, our unconscious mind. You know, people just don't like to admit this. It's like Westerners don't like to admit that there's a mind-body connection. So for the longest time, my teacher, Genki Roshi, used to tell me to straighten my back. And I didn't, I couldn't do it. It was difficult for me. And also, I just thought, oh, that's baloney. It doesn't matter how you sit. You know, the consciousness is, pure consciousness is consciousness. And of course, I didn't get anywhere until I started straightening my back. For one thing, the pain went away. My concentration got better and I felt better. And I had other problems too that began to go away when I sat properly. I was very resistant to this idea that there's a mind-body connection. But I was also very resistant to this idea that there's a kind of unconscious mind which is really important and bigger than little mind, our conscious mind. Which is not to say that conscious mind isn't important. You know, I still read books, you know, but different attitude. Now, I realize this is not the whole picture. I was just reading something the other day, for example, about the importance of smell. You may have heard about these pheromones, right? But it turns out that really when people get involved romantically with other people, smell may be the most important factor. Now, that's just ridiculous, isn't it? You know, you think, I married her because of her smell? You know, that can't be, you know. Wasn't it that, you know, night in Santa Fe when we walked under the stars and, you know, the sound of her laugh and to say it's just her smell? That's insane, right? And, you know, that would be crazy. That would be like, we would think that's kind of like madness. That would be a mad universe, right? But you know, if you think about it, it's not so crazy. You know, it's not so crazy. You know, I can remember, I have to confess to you that sometimes when I go to see my mother and I kiss her on the forehead, I can smell her hair, you know? And I can somehow remember the smell of my mother's hair. And it's the smell of my mother, you know, who I really love. And when I was a little boy, I could remember the smell of my father's sweat. You know, and it's the smell of my father. When he was dying, I could smell it. I could smell my father. You know, we have a kind of a view of ourselves, which is very shallow. You know, as if everything we do has to do with ideas. But, you know, we are whole beings, whole body creatures. You know, we think smell is lower than thinking, right? You know, smell is like inferior body sensation. But, you know, when I think of, I can still remember my father's smell. I can't remember it right now, but every once in a while when I'm sitting, I can remember that smell. You know, and I can see his face with sweat working in the garden. And I can see him smoking the cigarettes that, I can smell the tobacco that killed him. And so smell is not so trivial, not so lowly and inferior. You know, where, you know, these kinds of things are very important. You know? And we register these things on a deeper level. You know? So, you know, I was reading this and thinking, you know, yes, you know, it's really like this. You know, we don't make decisions consciously. We think we do. But, you know, we really, I was just reading again. You know, they've done studies all over the world. They show human beings pictures of different locations. And they say, pick the location that makes you feel best. And they show them pictures of different settings. One is like a jungle, right? One is like a desert. You know, there's like a, and there's some scenes that are, there's one picture in particular, which is this, you're in the woods. It's like you're in a forest or something, and you're looking out at open space, and there's some water in front of you, you know? So you're at the edge of, like, the forest, or you're standing under some trees. You're looking out in an open space, and there's water. Do you know that, according to the study, honestly, it was like 70-some percent of people everywhere, Russia, China, Africa, India, South of 70% of people picked that picture. Right? You know, and there were people who picked the desert, there were, but the great majority of people picked that particular picture. And they, and that this was in a scientific article, and it said, you know, probably this reflects a deep evolutionary heritage. You know, as people who, we were arboreal creatures who moved out into the plains. You know, we safest place is at the edge of the forest. We can see, listen, have some water. You know, it sounds crazy, but why not? You know, this is like a deep, our deep hard wiring says, you know, this is a comfortable spot. You know, and is it so crazy to think we make many decisions on the basis of factors like this that never come to consciousness? About a year ago, Scientific American had an article on a famous Japanese rock garden at Ryoanji in Japan, Rinzai Temple in Japan. And this temple has a famous, you've probably seen pictures of it, stones. It's a gravel garden, and the stones are very carefully raked every day to create the forms in the gravel like waves. And in the middle of the gravel, there are these rocks that come up. So it's like a sea of gravel, and in the middle of the sea of gravel, there are these stones. And they're beautiful stones. You know, the Japanese learned this from the Chinese. The Chinese love to use stones in their interesting stones in their gardens. And the principles of Chinese and Japanese gardening are very profound psychological principles. So at any rate, in Ryoanji, they have these raked white gravel in an enclosure, courtyard. And then in the gravel, there are like these stones that come rising out of the white gravel, and they're like gray granite stones. And they're ancient, covered with moss. And they're arranged in sort of an odd way on the gravel. And they were wondering how this is, how what the secret, this is like a koan. This is a koan. And some cognitive scientists were very interested in this, because they were interested in how people process this on a deep, unconscious level. So, you know, consciously, you look at it and say it's beautiful, or it's ugly, or I don't get it, or I get it. But they were interested in how it registers on an unconscious level. And they actually say, you know, here's what it, how it, here's what it is on the unconscious. It's not rocks. And what they argue, as I recall, was that it, on the unconscious level, this registers as a tree. That this registers with a certain cognitive like archetypes on a deep level, and on the a part of your brain knows that this is a tree. So you look at stones here, and the placement says tree. Now this is just like a koan. In fact, this is a koan. They ruined the koan by publishing the answer in science, so they'll have to move them around. Right? So it won't be tree anymore. It'll be fish or something like that. But the point is, three or four points on this field can establish on a deep level meaning, on a deep unconscious level. And koans work the same way. See, this is really, this koan's not really about staff or dragon. It's about something else. You have to process it unconsciously. So, you know, in this case, a key phrase, turning phrase, or this, swallowed up the universe. See, what does that mean? Swallowed up the universe, right? But you sit on the cushion, you straighten your back, you watch your breath until you enter deep samadhi. Then you go into mu-shin, into an empty mind. And then, little by little, you just say, swallow the universe. Something happens. And it's just a matter of being open and being patient. See, this is the essence of of Zen practice, being open and being patient. And when the door opens, it feels just wonderful, because it's like a deep, deep whole body, whole being encounter with the universe. It's just wonderful. And if those of you who are working with the Mu Koan, some of you are working with the Mu Koan, you know, that's a wonderful koan. After you begin to work with the breath, sooner or later you enter a state of deep concentration called samadhi. In that state, you may feel that your hands or your face are disappearing when you sit. You feel very still, or like you're in deep in something. You don't know what, but you feel like you're in something. And then when you can enter that state, rather predictably, the teacher gives you the Mu Koan. And this is the koan of emptiness meditation. So you call, as you breathe out, you call. And at the end of your breath, if you look at your mind, it should be blank or dark, and you just keep going back to that blank darkness. Now, you know, when little mind looks at that blank darkness, all it ever sees is nothing. So little mind just sits there for 2 years and says, nothing's happening, nothing's happening. And it gets worried, it gets depressed. Little mind says, well, maybe I shouldn't be in Zen. You know, maybe I should try something else. You know, maybe I'll never answer this koan. You know, I'm no good, I knew I was no good, you know, whatever. But all this time you're working with the koan, see, it's operating on a deeper level. One day, you know, you begin to feel like maybe something's happening. And something's happening. It's not what you expect, right? You know, it's like, that's odd. I wonder why I feel that way, you know? It's like, you know, I feel odd. That's strange. Why not? And you might even say, this has nothing to do with my koan. You know, but little by little, something happens. And you feel it, and you push it aside as unimportant, and then it comes back. And you suddenly you notice, you know, what is happening? And you really don't know. See, that's the wonderful thing. It's reality, right? I mean, if I say, you should have this, this, and this, or if I say reality is like this, and then you experience something that seems to confirm what I've said, that's okay, right? But if the teacher says your koan is mu, and then you're sitting on this cushion and the darndest thing happens, and you feel like your head has been blown off or something, that's reality, right? Nobody told you that was going to happen. It just happened. That's Einstein's wandering through the dark halls and coming out into the light. Right? So you smack dab into reality. And the reality is so much bigger than little mind can comprehend. So much bigger. I mean, this is kind of the tragedy, right? And it's the wonderful thing about human life. But people live in such a small world, and it's not necessary. You know, you can be a dragon, you know, if you want. You know, just start being a dragon. And how do you do that? Sitting for 10 minutes, then sitting for half an hour, then sitting three times a week, then coming to Saturday sit, then doing sesshin, all the time, entering this empty mind, blockhead, blockhead, blockhead. And the strange thing is, you know, you feel more alive, you feel more energy, you feel more joy, you know, and more connection, all the time, connection, connection. So Umon is a great Zen teacher. We've met him before in other koans. He comes in and he holds up his staff and he says to the assembly, this staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Your koan is swallowed up the universe. Swallowed up the universe. Swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world? Oh, this is like brilliant koan. And I hope we have the chance to do it together. Secho's verse. The staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the water. In other words, that's a poetic formula. That's just a commonplace that floats around. what is actually happening to you right now on the cushion when you say swallowed up the universe. Now, the fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. That's true, you know. You may get your tail singed, you know, when you're working with the koan. But the ones that lie with gills exposed, you know, when you're doing your koan and you don't know where to turn, you're like a fish out of water, right? Gills exposed. Don't lose heart. Don't lose heart. So you're never a fish out of water. That's a fantasy. That's a fantasy. Everything is your water. You're a fish and everything is your water. Everything is your water. You know, there's a little parable from ancient to Buddhist scripture about a man who imagined he had lost his head. You know, he just was a little bit too conceptual. And he decided he had lost it. He concluded intellectually he had lost his head and went looking everywhere for his head. Of course, it's right there all the time. This is a problem of living too much in conceptual reality. So, you know, this idea of I'm a fish out of water, I'm desperate, I don't have the answer, all of this is just, these are just ideas, pay no attention to them. As soon as you sit on the cushion and you think, oh, I'm getting nowhere, this is not working out, don't ever listen to that. That's the voice of, just don't listen to it. It's baloney. It's baloney. That's not the voice of your true self. Just have patience, be persistent, and you'll feel better. You won't even know why. This is the life of Zen. Deep mushing. Don't know. Einstein, that was his life. You know, he was a physicist. He didn't work with consciousness. He worked with physics. Much of his, you know, last part of his life was the search for a unified field theory. He never found it. For like 25 years, he was in the dark. You know, and didn't despair. You know, this was, he knew he was onto something. He was so alive. So alive, right? If he could have answered it in a day, what would have been the point? You know, so big obstacle is big. When we get blocked on the koan, so-called, you know, is big blockage, big reality. You know, big koan, big experience. So why not take on a big koan? Why not one hand clapping? So what if it takes 3 years? Who cares? This is life. You know, this is real life. Says, my verse is done, but do you really hear me? Only be carefree. Don't worry. Just sit. Only be carefree. That's it. Just sit on the cushion. Trust in your true self. Live in blockhead. Live in blockhead and then just trust. So hard to do, but it's such a wonderful life. Deepest life. 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150. What he says, what he means, this is Zen talk, right? In Zen talk, when the teacher says, when a person says about somebody else, he was an idiot, he means he was wonderful. So when Secho says 72 blows are not enough, I want to give you 150, he means I really love you. I really love you. Zen is really something, isn't it?